we're going to get started. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Bennett, and I'm the Assistant Archivist in the Museum Archives. I'm so pleased to be here today to present a lecture on a program that has sort of faded into obscurity since its closure in 1982. And the program that I'm referring to is the Art Lending Service of the Museum of Modern Art. Most of the material that I've used to present this presentation is from the Art Lending Service Art Advisory Service records, which are held in the museum archives. I gained an intimate knowledge of the inner workings of the ALS, which is how I'll refer to the Lending Service for the rest of this talk, while processing the records from 2004 to 2006. This lecture will provide an overview of the ALS from its inception in 1951 to its closure in 1982. I will focus on key events throughout the tenure of the ALS, such as the development of its penthouse exhibition series, the alumni program, its relationship to the museum's Department of Photography, and I will end with an overview of the penthouse program in the 1970s. Here you see a picture of the members' penthouse circa 1939, just sort of to set the stage. The Art Lending Service officially opened its doors in the museum on the sixth floor in 1951 under the leadership of a small group of members from the museum's Junior Council. For those of you unfamiliar with the Junior Council, it was a MoMA affiliates group comprised of young donors who organize events and activities to fundraise for the museum. The Junior Council's name was changed to the Associate Council in 1981 and to its current title of the Contemporary Arts Council in 1986. The Junior Council was formed in 1949, 20 years after the museum opened to the public, with, like the MoMA itself, the Rockefellers at its helm. Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, or Blanchette, led the initial group of the Junior Council, and many of its members later went on to become trustees of the museum. Almost at the outset of the council's formation, the idea of creating an art lending library began brewing within the group. During an extensive planning phase, which took place roughly from 1949 to 1951, the Junior Council's members discussed how the service would work, who would run it, how the inventory of artworks would be selected, what the rental terms would be, and on and on. From the very beginning, the objectives of the Junior Council's art lending program were clearly defined: to promote American artists, to cultivate collectors of modern art, and in doing so, to advance modern art in America. The Junior Council presented a formal appeal to the museum's Board of Trustees to make their case for the creation of an art lending service. In this account, the structure of the ALS was sketched out. Upon opening, the library would have an inventory of 300 works of art, ranging in value from $50 to $750. These works would be borrowed from local galleries for 9 months at a time, and if, at the end of that duration, the works were neither rented nor sold, they would be sent back to the gallery. It was also decided that the Junior Council would need to raise $7,000 to start the ALS. Members of the council solicited friends and family to raise the necessary funds, and donations came in from a variety of sources, including Blanchette Rockefeller's own mother. So here you see on the left a letter from Blanchette's mother granting her $1,000 towards her project. And on the right, you have a list of possible donors and how much they've pledged to give. The services of the ALS were limited to the museum's members. This, of course, was meant to encourage museum membership, and in doing so, to get museum visitors more involved in MoMA-sponsored activities. Works were rented for 3 months at a time for 10% of the purchase price. And if the work sold, the ALS would receive a 10% handling fee from the gallery who consigned the work. This was used to buy supplies and staff the ALS. Thus, the gallery, not the ALS, made a 90% profit on the sale, the idea being to foster New York galleries dealing in modern art. And here you see a blueprint. This was the original kind of needs, space needs that the ALS committee members came up with for the sixth floor of the museum. So you see the storage area on the left, at the bottom, the display shelving area, and you see how it's kind of connected to the members' lounge. To determine the structure of the program, the members of the ALS committee closely examined other lending libraries, paying special attention to the New York Circulating Library. Like the New York Circulating, the ALS rented prints and drawings, but they expanded beyond what the New York Circulating had on offer by adding paintings and sculptures and later photographs. Another obvious contrast between the New York Circulating and the ALS was that, unlike the library, the works in the ALS were for sale. Moreover, the rental period differed. The New York Circulating rented works of art for an indefinite amount of time, whereas the ALS rented works for 3 months. According to the ALS committee, they did not want borrowers, quote, decorating their homes, end quote, with artworks from the ALS without actually purchasing them. The goal being to create buyers, not just renters. Another major difference between the ALS and the New York Circulating and other lending libraries was that picture lending was conducted through the library, with librarians selecting the artworks on view. This was not so at MoMA. The selections made for the ALS was overseen by the curatorial staff of the museum. From the outset, each work that entered into the inventory was subject to the approval of Alfred H. Barr Jr., director of the museum's collections, Dorothy Miller and Margaret Miller, both curators, and Renee Darnincourt, the director of the museum. Following the museum's lead, they too wanted the works on offer to be a representation of the best modern art being produced. As I said, the goals of the ALS were clear at the outset of the program. They were, as stated in a memo, quote, to enlarge taste and understanding, to stimulate sales, thus aiding both artists and galleries, and to show that contemporary art can be enjoyed in the home as well as the museum, end quote. The desire to assist emerging artists and newly established galleries was strategic. A bustling art market was beneficial to the museum and to the advancement of modern art in America. However, it is also important to consider that in the 1950s, there was still skepticism towards modern art. Individuals at the MoMA, like Alfred Barr, were continually trying to increase the public's understanding and acceptance of modern art, and the ALS proved useful for this mission. It was a venue where those interested in modern art, but perhaps not fully committed to buying it, could take a chance, and hopefully this potential renter would become a buyer, and then perhaps a donor to the museum. The concept of art lending was not a new one. Women's auxiliary clubs, public libraries, and even museums had art lending programs when the ALS was conceived. In America, two librarians, John Cotton Dana, who you see here on the left, and Charles Cutter, created art lending programs in public libraries in Massachusetts and in Colorado around the turn of the 20th century. After establishing the first art lending program at the public library in Denver, John Cotton Dana moved east and began to write extensively about developments in public libraries as well as American art. Dana became head of the Newark Library in the Newark Museum in 1909. You see an installation view from the Newark Museum in 1909 here on the right. And led both institutions from 1909 until his death in 1929. I mention Dana because he is especially important to the history of the MoMA. Several members of the MoMA staff trained and worked with Dana at the New York Museum, including Dorothy Miller, who took a 10-month museum training course under Dana in 1925. Though Dana was not a, quote, fan of modern art, he was a huge advocate of American art. In one of his most influential texts, entitled American Art, and published in 1914, he describes how the public can remedy the inadequacy, as he saw it, of American art by, quote, becoming worthy and helpful patrons of it in the best sense of that word, end quote. And furthermore, Dana gives a simple formula to do so, quote, first we must buy it, next we must study it, next we must criticize it, and finally we must praise it where we can, end quote. Dana's mentorship undoubtedly had a profound effect on Dorothy Miller, and Miller's dedication to the promotion of American artists was exemplified at the outset of her tenure at the museum. Here you see an installation view of Dorothy Miller's Charles Sheeler exhibition in 1939, and then on the right, a photograph of Alfred Barr on the left, with Dorothy Miller in the center and James Thrall Sobey on the right. The very first solo exhibition that Miller organized at MoMA was Charles Sheeler in 1939. Miller was thus a perfect choice for the advisory committee for the Art Lending Service, as her devotion to the promotion of American artists was completely aligned with the aims of the ALS. In a statement written by Peggy Erskine, ALS staff, she stated, quote, "If we can do anything to encourage the discriminating support of living American artists by the public, our library will prove its usefulness," end quote. The preliminary list of artists selected for inclusion in the service's first months of operation was a conglomeration of living American artists such as Max Beckmann, George Gross, Alexander Calder, Stuart Davis, Robert Motherwell, and George O'Keefe, amongst many others. The quality of the artists represented in this wish list is interesting. Several of these artists, particularly Motherwell, Calder, and Davis, were outspoken in their advocacy of modern art, and specifically of abstract painting and sculpture. At a symposium entitled What Abstract Art Means to Me, sponsored by the Junior Council in 1951, the same year that the ALS opened, Motherwell, Calder, and Davis, along with Fritz Glarner, George L.K. Morris, and Willem de Kooning, explain their motivations for making abstract art. The symposium provided a glimpse into the working mind of an artist, perhaps fueling an appreciation for the thought processes of modern artists. The symposium was so successful that the remarks were published in the museum's bulletin, which you see the cover of here. The ALS continued to function throughout the early 1950s, renting and selling works that were hung on racks in the ALS offices. However, it was not until 1955 that the first formal penthouse exhibition was staged, fittingly in the members' penthouse. Thus, while continuing to support a large inventory of contemporary art, the ALS embarked upon a new program by putting together actual exhibitions. The exhibitions exemplified the variety of work available through the ALS program. And the first penthouse exhibition opened on January 7, 1955. This show included a small sampling of works by artists such as Malcolm Green, Willem de Kooning, Norman Lewis, Reginald Pollock, and Roberto Matta. Here I've just chosen a work by Norman Lewis just to give you an idea of the kinds of works that were on offer. This is actually in the museum's permanent collection. In the press release for this exhibition, the services of the ALS were outlined, and the new penthouse venture was explained as, quote, "a supplement to the regular operations of the art lending service, including a few works beyond the size and price range normally available," end quote. Thus, the ALS sort of upped the ante by increasing the prices of the works on offer in the penthouse shows. As an early memo indicates, the ALS committee members agreed that they wanted the public to look upon modern art as a valuable part of the home setting, as, quote, "indispensable as books and radios," end quote. I find this notion to be rather interesting, as it suggests that art, like books, can be both educational and enriching, and like the radio, art is an essential part of modern life and culture. It is a way to be in tune with the cultural developments of the day. This may not have been the exact conscious intention of the ALS committee members who wrote the memo, but I do think it is indicative of a shift in the way that people thought about art, and the idea that art should be a compelling addition to our everyday lives was aligned with the museum's viewpoints on both art and design. This was evident in the Good Design exhibitions in the early 1950s. From 1951 to 1955, there were five exhibitions of Good Design. Each of these shows included works of modern design intended to pique Americans' interest in modern living. Practicality, functionality, and aesthetics were highlighted. And modern art was considered part of this modern lifestyle. And here I've drawn a little arrow to show you how a painting was integrated into this modern grouping. By the late 1950s, the ALS was full of momentum, though the continuing success of the service was very much dependent upon the appointment of a full-time art advisor who would be held accountable for selecting the works for the library's inventory while working in tandem with the ALS committee, curators, and such to organize the penthouse exhibitions. Jane Sobirsky was hired for this position in 1958. Sobirsky had been the assistant to Kurt Valentin, the director of the Buchholz Gallery from 1939 to 1944, and she worked in the Department of Circulating Exhibitions at MoMA from 1945 to 1955, so she had an intimate knowledge of the gallery world as well as the museum. Though Sobirsky stayed in this position for only 1 year, during her tenure, she assisted in coordinating an exhibition that included 81 watercolors selected by Dorothy Miller for an exhibition that circulated to France entitled Recent American Watercolorists. Miller suggested that the ALS display the works in the penthouse so that they could be rented and sold, and a number of them did sell. Here you see a photograph of a work by Joan Mitchell that was included in the show entitled Untitled. And here, this is another work included in the show by Robert Parker, entitled Italian Diplomats. And finally, this is a Franz Klein included, and it is entitled Black and White. The ALS retrospective, which ran from January 26th to March 20th, 1960, was an extremely important show, as it reinforced the excellent reputation of the ALS. A small catalog was produced for the show, and the works were of museum quality. Overall, the exhibition included 54 paintings, prints, drawings, and sculptures. And here you see the cover of the small catalog created for the retrospective. After visiting the exhibition, what museum member wouldn't have wanted to be in on the action? It was exciting. To give a very, very, very small sampling of the artists and works included, here on the right you have Joseph Albers' study for homage to the square, and the work on the right was one of the Nightshade series that was included. And then here you have Ellie Nadelman's Acrobat. I chose these two works in particular because they give an idea of the variety of works on display. You have color field paintings, figural sculptures, and on and on. The diversity of the displayed works was interesting, and it showed the breadth of works on offer through the ALS, while illustrating that modern art could come in many forms and iterations. And the press spoke favorably about the ALS and the first retrospective. Its prices were reasonable in the eyes of the New York Herald, and in an article entitled Art for the Masses, the emphasis was on accessibility for all, not just wealthy collectors. In October of 1960, the ALS's first exhibition, dedicated solely to photography, opened in the penthouse. It was entitled Photography for Collectors. Co-curated by Edward Steichen and Grace Mayer, the exhibition included photographs by Eugène Agier. You see a work here on the left. It's Rue des Avenues Gobelins. It's a very famous photograph. So works by Agier ranged from $25 to $40. Harry Callahan, which you see a work on the right entitled Weeds, had works on offer from $25 to $40, as well as works by Imogen Cunningham, which you see a photograph of at the bottom. This is Ruth Asawa working with her children, as well as many others. The most expensive work in the exhibition was a portfolio of photographs for $275. The ALS had a long-standing relationship with the museum's Department of Photography. It proved to be an excellent place in which to expose museum members to fine art photography. After Photography for Collectors, the Penthouse exhibition series continued, but the shows could be construed as somewhat perfunctory. Numerous exhibitions throughout the early 1960s were somewhat rote. Selections from the ALS, Christmas sales, and penthouse exhibitions abounded. However, it was during this time that an adjunct program called the Art Advisory Service was developed, tailored to suit the needs of the budding corporate collector. The Art Advisory Service opened in 1964 and courted corporate members of the museum by offering art collecting and curatorial services as a part of corporate membership. Thus, it could be argued that some of the energy in the Penthouse exhibition series was, for a short while, redirected to the Art Advisory Service. However, by 1967, the ALS offices were renovated, giving the staff an updated space, which included a viewing rack and a photography storage cabinet. Later that year, another exhibition was devoted to collections amassed through the ALS. Members Collect included works by artists such as Roy Lichtenstein, Victor Vassarelli, Pablo Picasso, Paul Klee, René Dubuffet, and Pavel, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I apologize, Chulichev, and many others. And here you see MoMA members with their works purchased through the ALS. At the bottom is William Zierler with his Lichtenstein Small Explosion, Mrs. Robert C. Lenhart at the top left with her Chulichev Balanced Space, and Douglas Campbell on the right with his Vassarelli's Untitled. These photographs were taken as publicity shots for the exhibition, and they demonstrate, I would argue, how modern art can be successfully integrated into the lives of everyday people, whether in the home or the office. By 1969, the relevancy of the ALS came into question. Many members of the museum staff felt that the ALS had become unnecessary and outdated, and that the Junior Council should focus its efforts on other museum activities. By this time, the museum had a solid base of members and donors, and American artists and New York galleries were on fairly secure footing. Though the relevancy question was somewhat of a problem from the late 1960s until the ALS actually closed in 1982, for the time being, the ALS was spared from closure. Oops, just gotta go back. New ideas were put into motion to guarantee the ALS's relevancy, one of which was to assist the Department of Photography by cultivating more photography collectors. To do so, the concept of a reproduction series was pitched, which would be a combined effort with the Department of Photography. The idea was to have a select group of photographers produce a special edition of 10 prints of one picture and sell these portfolios through the ALS to museum members. The profits would be slated for the Department of Photography to expand upon its collection of young photographers. Unfortunately, only a part of this project actually came to fruition, with the sale of a portfolio of prints by Eugène Agé in 1978. And here you have a picture of John Sarkowski from the 1960s. Another idea was to educate the public about the benefits of collecting fine art photographs, which would, hopefully, stimulate photography sales. Photographs were more reasonably priced and appealed, in theory, to a broader audience. John Sarkowski, then chief curator of the Department of Photography, held several lectures sponsored by the ALS on the topic of what to look for in a photograph, geared towards the new photography collector. In the early 1970s, the ALS began a side program to cultivate collectors through alumni outreach. Though they had conducted marketing campaigns for decades, the alumni events were a focused way to attract young members. Parties and events were organized at the museum for universities such as Mills College, Cornell University, Stanford, and Harvard, amongst others. Participants were given a tour of the ALS library and the penthouse exhibition on view, and then treated to hors d'oeuvres and cocktails. In addition, the ALS marketed themselves to, quote, young tycoons on Wall Street, end quote, as Barbara Jacobson, currently a museum trustee and former chair of the Junior Council, phrased it. These targeted efforts bolstered interest in collecting amongst those with a disposable income. Arguably, the heyday of the ALS occurred during the 1970s under the leadership of Barbara Jacobson. Miss Jacobson had and has an amazing amount of energy, and thanks to her leadership and guidance, the Penthouse Exhibition Program experienced a sort of renaissance. She was personally committed to the realization of several exhibitions during the 1970s, including Prints from Halifax, Works from Change, Inc., and 76 Jefferson, each of which were groundbreaking efforts for the ALS Penthouse Exhibitions Program. Prince from Halifax was probably one of the most timely exhibitions carried out by the ALS. It seemed that it had its finger on the pulse of contemporary art. Installed in 1971, when performance, minimalism, body art, etc. were still very kind of avant-garde and obscure, the show highlighted interdisciplinary practices in contemporary art. The 47 lithographs on display were produced by artists at the lithography workshop of the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax. And here you actually see a crib sheet that was created for the ALS staffers, showing the arrangement of a suite of works by Saul DeWitt at the top, and at the bottom, works by Vito Acconci, Dan Graham, and Dennis Oppenheim. During the 1970s, the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design was a haven for contemporary artists. As the exhibition's press release noted, the workshop attracted Canadian, American, and European artists interested in pursuing their specific mode of working, whether figural, abstract, minimalist, etc., through lithography. The workshop was a sort of mentorship program for young artists to work collaboratively with more established artists. Prints from Halifax included artists such as Saul DeWitt, Vito Acconci, John Baldessari, Robert Ryman, and Dennis Oppenheim, each of whom was a visiting artist at the school. And here you see an installation view from the show. You have two works by Robert Ryman on the left. Here's another installation view, and you see how kind of that crib sheet plays out. You have the Acconci works in the center, works by Dan Graham on the right, and then on the far right, works by Dennis Oppenheim. And here you have two works by Acconci. On the left is Trademarks, and on the right you have Kiss Off. Works by Acconci were on sale for $125 to $150. And works by John Baldessari were only $100, very inexpensive by today's standards. After the exhibition ended, the show circulated to venues throughout the country, including the Albright Knox Gallery in Buffalo, the Detroit Institute of the Arts, and Cal State Hayward in California. This was the first ALS show that toured to other institutions after it closed at MoMA. Works from Change, Inc. was an exhibition that reinforced the philanthropic efforts of the museum and the ALS. Change, Inc. was a nonprofit organization conceived by Robert Rauschenberg in 1970 and established by a board of directors who included Rauschenberg, Alana Heiss, director of PS1, and Leo Castelli, Rauschenberg's dealer. The policy of Change, Inc. was to provide grants to visual artists for emergency needs such as rent, medical expenses, losses from accidents, etc. And here you see an article about Rauschenberg and Change Inc. and Women's Wear Daily. Rauschenberg initiated Change Inc. based on his own experience as a struggling artist, unable to attain credit cards or small loans. The exhibition was organized not as a benefit per se, but as a, quote, goodwill measure towards the art community of New York, end quote. Artists were asked by Rauschenberg to donate works to the exhibition, and Change Inc. would then receive the proceeds of the sales. Artists included in the show were Warhol, Frank Stella, Saul DeWitt, Roy Lichtenstein, Cy Twombly, and others. And here you see a letter from Susan Ginsberg. She was the guest curator of the show, to Barbara Jacobson, guaranteeing the commitment of Warhol, Rosenquist, and Frank Stella. The following year, another exhibition that highlighted artists' collectives and alternative communities was staged in the penthouse. It was called 76 Jefferson. Here you see the front door of the 76 Jefferson building in the Lower East Side. The exhibition was named for the artist collective located at 76 Jefferson Street. The building was slated for demolition, even though it was, as Barbara Jacobson described it, a, quote, marvelous broken-down loft building, noted for the number of first-rate painters who have passed through its doors, end quote. And as you can see by this photograph, her description is quite accurate. Jacobson fully supported the 76 Jefferson exhibition, and in a memo to William Rubin, then chief curator of the Department Painting of Sculpture. She suggested that the collective and its artists should be videotaped for the education program at the museum. Though this did not actually occur, the exhibition was installed, and it included works by artists such as Janet Fish, Bryce Marden, and others. Here you see a fun photograph of the 76 Jefferson Streeters hanging out of their windows, holding their artworks with them. And on the right is an article that was in the Village Voice, which, of course, used the photograph. And here you have an invitation to the opening. In addition to original works of art, there was a prominent presence of lithographs produced by Chiron Press, who were formerly located in the 76 Jefferson Building. This part of the show included prints by artists who had worked with the press, such as Alex Katz, Robert Indiana, Robert Motherwell, and Andy Warhol. Here you see two different screen prints of Alex Katz's rowboat. One of these was included in the exhibition. I'm not entirely sure which one. Later in 1975, the ALS held the first penthouse exhibition dedicated to architecture and design. Architectural Studies and Projects opened on March 13th and featured recent drawings by American and European architects. Here you see a review of the show in the New York Times. And here's the invitation to the opening. Similar to many of the architectural projects now on view in the architecture and design galleries at MoMA, the show included drawings of visionary projects and imaginary creations never intended to be built. As the curator, Emilio Ambaz, phrased it, quote, "The drawings are not the plan or facade for a specific construction, but rather the expression of an idea or an attitude towards architecture," end quote. Architectural Studies included works by young architects such as Super Studio. I've included just two images here to give you an idea of the kinds of works that Super Studio does, as well as more well-known architects such as Peter Eisenman. And this is one of Eisenman's house constructions. The exhibitions reflected the most current trends in architecture and design, designs that evoked fantasy, whimsy, and utopianism in monuments and residences alike, and they presented, perhaps, a more contemporary alternative to the modern lifestyle. As the 1970s drew to a close, it seemed that the ALS had served its purpose. The art market, though not perfect, was self-sustaining. And by the early 1980s, it became clear that the energy funneled into the ALS program should be redirected to the Art Advisory Service. The corporate collector took over the role of the individual collector. Corporations had more buying power and wanted to build collections to display in their corporate headquarters for the benefits of their workforce. And here you see a mock-up of a brochure that the ALS created but was never realized, with Bruce Nauman's Studies for Holograms Making Faces. But I think the quotation is apt with times change. Though the ALS closed in 1982, its efforts were lasting. The museum had succeeded in building an audience for modern art by cultivating collectors, and in doing so, the ALS helped to create a legacy of benefactors and donors to the Museum of Modern Art, as well as other art institutions throughout America. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
How many of these works of art actually came back to the museum after they were purchased?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm not sure. That would probably take a lot of extensive research. But, I mean, probably some of them, I would definitely imagine. And, I mean, many of the people involved, as I said, with the Junior Council and who were members were also, you know, came to be involved in the museum on a more kind of intense level, I guess you'd say, later on. Does anyone else?
Do you know of any current
art lending programs? There are still many. A lot of universities have art lending programs, and just for fun, I did a Google search on art lending, and I found programs all over the world. I came upon hits, I think, in Finland, Slovenia, all over Europe. It's definitely still very common. Actually, the San Francisco MoMA also has a young artist gallery, and they do kind of, I don't know if they do like an art lending sort of on the model of MoMA, but it's kind of the same thing. It's a lot of emerging artists who people can, you know, borrow and then eventually purchase works. So, does anyone else have any questions? No? Okay. Thank you.